This is tape one of a two-tape series on evidence that demands a verdict, a special program presenting objective, scientific evidence in support of special creation and the historical Christ. The subject of this tape is Historical Evidence for the Deity and Resurrection of Jesus Christ by Tom Anderson. Mr. Anderson has held many executive posts with the Association of Trial Lawyers of America and the California Trial Lawyers Association. He is currently with the Judicial Council for the State of California. Tom is named in Who's Who in American Law and is co-author of the Association of Trial Lawyers of America Basic Advocacy Manual. He currently maintains law offices in Indio and Palm Springs, California.
We have a lot of material to cover. And frankly, it's a kind of heavy material. And it usually isn't done at this late at night. I just hope that the things that we do here can give you some insight into the subject matter that we're going to discuss with you. It's the intent of this meeting not to be an evangelical meeting, not to be a prayer meeting. We're going to have a minimum of tent talk, but we're going to have cross-examination at the end. And when we say cross-examination, we don't want you to hold back anything, because we're not so confident that we have the answers, but we know that somebody else has the answers. We're going to prevent a factual discussion concerning this subject matter. What you're going to hear from me, really, is the struggle that I went through to acquaint myself with the facts concerning the evidence of Jesus Christ. About a little over 3 years ago, I decided that success as a trial lawyer wasn't all that fulfilling. I had reached the conclusion that another car, a bigger case, just really wasn't getting the job done. And you start searching. And my search led to an investigation of the evidence concerning Christ. What you're going to hear today are some of the conclusions that I reached and some of the factual matters that I went through in analyzing that evidence. Now, when I raised my hand and said, I believe, I didn't have some angelic hosts come down. I didn't have some vision. And I want to confess something to you. I really was kind of scared. I said, what in the world are you getting yourself into, Anderson? But the evidence was so compelling. The evidence itself was so compelling that I did, as Bob indicated, accept Christ. Now, I would like to suggest something to you. I would like to have each of you examine your frame of mind as you sit there right now. And let me pose a question to you. If I could prove that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, that he really was crucified, that he really did rise again from the dead, would you believe it? Now, if you're like me, prior to the time that I investigated the evidence, your answer would be no. I wouldn't believe it, even if you proved it. Why? Because my state of mind was such that I rejected everything that was supernatural. Let me make another suggestion to you concerning your frame of mind. Do each of you believe that the information set forth, the factual information set forth in the Bible, is true? Well, my frame of mind was such that I rejected it. And I had to be honest with myself. Why did I reject it? Well, it certainly wasn't as a result of any studying, because I did not study it. I rejected it out of ignorance, but I rejected it. Now, similarly, I don't suggest this. I don't suggest that you put the evidence that we're presenting to you on any different basis than you would any other evidence in any court of law or in analyzing any ancient literature. What I'm saying is this. Whether the evidence that we present is true or false should be depend solely on what you hear concerning the evidence itself and nothing else. Now, I want to share something else with you. When I started my walk, I concluded that everybody who was a believer of necessity had to have blind faith. I assumed that as soon as you looked into the factual data in the Bible, that your faith would be shattered. That conclusion that I had was made again out of ignorance. One of the first things that I discovered when reading the Bible was when a lawyer, and it was a lawyer, who asked our Lord, "Master, what is the..." And he thought he's going to trap him, see? "What is the most important law of Moses?" Answer: "Christ said, love the Lord with all your heart, with all your soul..." Now get this. "With all your mind." When I read that, does he really mean that? Does that mean that we are at liberty to really investigate what he tells us with our mind as well as our emotion? I read on a little bit more. I discovered again, he says in John, "Christ said, you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Not accept me on blind faith, but investigate the truth. That to me gave me a total license from Christ to do exactly that, to search the truth. Because when my walk started, I didn't study this subject matter to believe. I really think in my heart I studied it to reject it. And I've heard that story so many times. I want to say a word about a subject matter that frequently comes up, and that's to our good Jewish friends. You know, when Christ came on this earth, the first thing he did was to buy a plot of land that was a little bit bigger than the Second Temple, right? And start a new church. No, that's not what he did. What did he do? Well, at the age of 12, after his parents had been attending the High Holy Days in Jerusalem, and they noticed that he was gone, they went back to Jerusalem, and where did they find him? They found him in Herod's second temple. And what was he doing? He was teaching. And when his parents asked him, "Why are you here?" he says, "I have to be in my father's house." If you follow his life, you will discover every time he went to a town, where did he go? The new Christian church? No, he went to the synagogue. At the age of 31, he got so upset when he saw the money changers selling pigeons, selling all sorts of things on the steps of the Second Temple, that he got angry. He got so angry, as you know, that he threw out the money changers, and when he was asked, he says, "They're desecrating my father's house." When you analyze who wrote the Bible, you'll discover that all of the books of the Bible, with perhaps the exception of one, was written by Jewish authors. As a matter of fact, Christ, during his life, would not permit any teaching to anybody except the Jews. And finally, when he referred to the Jews, he referred to them as his hidden treasure. So the plan of Jesus Christ was exactly what I said. His church was there, and it was the synagogue. I also found out something even before I became a believer. And that is this, that Jesus Christ was very, very unique. Now, wouldn't you assume that a man who says that he's king of the Jews, is the Son of God, all of these other things, would be born in some regal family, would come from some palace? It's been my experience when you study the Word, you find out the way the world does things, and Christ did it exactly the opposite. For example, when he decided to designate his disciples, what he got was a group of scholars, right? No. He chose some lousy fishermen and one tax gatherer. Of course, what Christ did also was to compose and write a series of books. I'd like to have you go down, please, and look in the library under Christ Jesus and see how many things you find. You find zero. Here was a man, true God and true man, who was born in a manger, maybe even in a cave, was a carpenter during his life, was reared on the wrong side of the tracks. As a matter of fact, when Philip told Nathanael where Jesus lived, he says, "In Nazareth. Can any good thing come out of Nazareth?" You read that in John 1. He lived 3 recorded years, 3 short years, and as a result of living a life, and that's all he did, the world was changed. Now that to me was unique. That was so unique to me, even before I became a believer, that it was staggering. He was an itinerant preacher. He didn't travel more than 40 miles from his hometown. And a world was changed as a result of a life. I'd like to discuss now the Bible, and this part of my talk should take the next 3 hours. No. Now it fails and becomes 3. No. When we discuss the Bible, again, let me suggest to you something. That you not have any presuppositions that it's true or false. But you let the evidence conclude your verdict. Again, I noticed something even before I became a believer. I noticed that the Bible was unique. Here's a book. And let me just review some basics. That was written over a period of 1,600 years, 66 different books, 40 different authors. If you look at the lifestyles of those authors, they came from all walks of life. Kings were authors. Peasants were authors. Cupbearers, shepherds, fishermen, rabbis. If you analyze where the book was written, they were written in, for example, in dungeons, prisons, on a throne, written over in 3 different continents, Europe, Africa, and Asia, in 3 different languages, Aramaic, Greek, and Hebrew. And I want to tell you this. There is one central, reconcilable theme concerning the entire Bible, and that's God's redemption of man. I can't think, and nobody can think, of one controversial book that's been written on any controversial subject where the authors totally agree. Even 2 authors agree, let alone 40. Now, let me just give you one example. The Old Testament consists, 25% of the Old Testament consists of prophecies. In Leviticus, written in 1500 B.C., and the book of Ezekiel, written in 590 B.C., the following prediction is made concerning Palestine, now known as Israel. It says, first, that your cities are going to be laid waste. Second, your sanctuaries are going to be destroyed. Third, your people are going to be dispersed. And finally, your people are going to come back again to Israel. Now, here we have two separate prophecies made over 900 years apart. And it's only one example that I can cite to you where there is total consistency. And you'll find that when you study the word, that there is total consistency factually. In reference to the argument, and you've heard this so many times, that listen, the Bible wasn't really transcribed accurately. I mean, you've had so many people write this Bible. How in the world do you know that it's accurate? Before 1947, there was a problem. The oldest complete manuscript we had of the Bible was transcribed 900 years after the birth of Christ. When I use the term manuscript, I'm talking about a handwritten manuscript. 900 years after the birth of Christ. About the only thing that we could point to establish that the book was transcribed accurately was the discipline of the Jewish scribes, where they were required when they were transcribing the Bible to wear a cloak. If they were transcribing the word one, they couldn't remember that it's spelled O-N-E, but they'd have to write it O-O-N-N-E. If the king came in, they couldn't look up and all those arguments. But still, there's room for human error. Then in 1947, a Bedouin shepherd on the shores of the Dead Sea had lost a goat. He tried to get the goat back by throwing a stone. As a result of throwing the stone, it went into a cave, and he was breaking. He went down there and discovered what we now know as the Dead Sea Scrolls. What did that show us as far as the accuracy of the transcription? Well, I'll tell you what it showed us. They compared the book of Isaiah with the book that we know was written before the time of Christ, with the book that was written 900 years after Christ, and they found that it was 96% accurate. What does that tell us? And the 4%, incidentally, was spelling. That means that we can rely on the manner in which the book, the Bible, was transcribed as being accurate. The second thing it showed us. You see, the prophecies were so exact that there were a series of treatises written in which they said this book had to be written after the birth of Christ because you can't be so right concerning the predictions about Jesus Christ. Paleographers studied the Dead Sea Scrolls and established without any doubt that the transcription of the Dead Sea Scrolls was written 125 years before the birth of Christ. And when we discuss the Messianic prophecies in a moment, that's going to be particularly revealing. The argument was also made that there are really no ancient manuscripts. That there was too long between the time that the original books of the Bible were written and the transcriptions, that it has to be inaccurate. We now have what is known as the Rylands manuscript that we can establish is a scrap of the chapter of John that was written 30 years after the Apostle John originally wrote that gospel. What do we have as far as other ancient literature is concerned? If you examine the evidence, you'll find that the books of Plato, that 1,200 years existed between the time it was originally written and the oldest manuscript that we have. Aristotle, 1,400 years. The book of Caesar, 1,000 years. If you analyze the Bible on the basis of the number of transcripts, you'll find that the New Testament has 13,000 manuscripts. Caesar, 10. Plato, 7. Aristotle, 8. So if you throw out the Bible on the basis that there are not enough manuscripts, that there was too long a period of time existing, you're going to throw out all of ancient literature. Now, why is this so important? We've established now that the book was accurately transcribed. We've established that the number of transcripts indicate its accuracy. Where do we go from here? The Messianic prophecies. This is something that was so compelling to me when I studied them that the only word I can think of is awesome. Let me first of all explain to you all of you know this, but the Messianic prophecies are those prophecies that exist in the Old Testament concerning the Messiah and the Son of God. There are 71 prophecies in the Old Testament that we now know were written before Christ that specifically describe when the Messiah will be born, where he will be born, the specifics of his death, the specifics of his resurrection. It's all 71 of them. Now, to give you an analogy so you can understand the impact of this, let's assume that there was a book that was written about John F. Kennedy. And this book was written 400 to 1,500 years before the birth of John F. Kennedy. And let's assume that this book specifically foretold that he's going to be born in Boston. He's going to go to Hyannisport. He's going to be president of the United States. He's going to be killed in Dallas. It describes the manner in which he's going to be killed. It describes that he's going to be buried in Arlington. And you now have the Messianic prophecies in a nutshell. Because there actually is exactly what I'm saying in reference to the Messianic prophecies and the predictions concerning Jesus Christ. 71 different predictions. And we'll now discuss all 71. We will not. Micah 5:2. If you read Micah 5:2, you'll see that 700 years before the birth of Christ, a prediction was made that Christ, the Messiah, will be born in Bethlehem. Now, you know, when I read that as a skeptical lawyer, I said, that's no problem. Mary and Joseph had access to the book. All they'd have to do is to read it and realize they had to fulfill their prophecies, go to Bethlehem and have Jesus. I want to recite some history to you. How was it that they got there? Voluntarily? No. How did they get there? A pagan, Caesar Augustus, told them that all Jews that lived in Nazareth have to go to Bethlehem for the purpose of taking a census. It gets even more awesome. If you read the books, you'll find that during the period of time that Mary was pregnant, there was a petition by the Jews to Rome saying it's not right for we Jews to have to go to Bethlehem for the purpose of taking a census. So there was a delay. We don't know how long, but at least weeks and perhaps months. God's timing was so exquisite that that problem was resolved. Keep in mind now, these were the Jews that were petitioning that Mary went to Bethlehem and had the Lord Jesus at precisely God's timing. Thus, we have the fulfillment of a prophecy, not by believers, but by pagans. I want to read to you Psalm 22, a portion of Psalm 22. This is a psalm that was written 1,000 years before the birth of Christ. A band of evildoers has encompassed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. They look. They stare at me. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing, they cast lots. You see the problem with that. And this is why you see the argument that was initially made. Listen, this book had to be written after Christ was born because this is just too much to handle. It is a little bit too much to handle, isn't it? 1,000 years before Christ, David wrote this. At a time that the Jews didn't even know anything about crucifixion. This is an invention of the Greeks and the Romans. We have here, again, a fulfillment of prophecy by pagans, where it says, they divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. The history books record exactly what happened. That's exactly what the Roman soldiers did, is that they divided Christ's garments among them, a prophecy that was written 1,000 years before the birth of Christ. He was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and like one from whom men hide their face. He was despised, and we did not esteem him. Surely our griefs he himself bore, and our sorrows he carried. Yet we ourselves esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was pierced through for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The chastening for our well-being fell upon him. And by his scourging, we are healed. All of us like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way. But the Lord has caused the iniquity of us all to fall on him. Because he poured himself out to death, and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he himself bore the sin of many and interceded for the transgressors. You know, you could read that to anybody in the world and you could ask him, what does that describe? And that describes the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Anybody in the world would tell you that. But the next amazing thing is that when you tell them that this was written by the prophet Isaiah, 750 years before the birth of Christ. I want to read the 9th verse of that. And this is a gem. His grave was assigned to be with wicked men, yet with a rich man in his death. Do you recall when Christ was crucified? He was crucified between two thieves. His grave was assigned to be with wicked men. What's the next event that history records? Joseph of Arimathea, a Secret Service Christian, a member of the Sanhedrin, a rich man, asked Pontius Pilate for the body of Jesus Christ and buried him in his tomb. Let me read that again. His grave was assigned to be with wicked men, yet with a rich man in his death. Is this just luck? You see, there is no other book in the world that has ever been written that specifically foretells things like this. The thing I was confronted with when I read this is explaining it away, and I couldn't. Isaiah 7:14. Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will be with child and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel. That's a newspaper account of the birth of Jesus Christ, right? Wrong. Written by the prophet Isaiah, again, 750 years before Christ's birth. Incidentally, the word Emmanuel means God with us. So we have a specific prediction again concerning the virgin birth. Now, an interesting subject is, what are the mathematical probabilities of something like this occurring? You know, the field of mathematical probabilities is a science. The following question was posed to a scientist in the field of mathematical probabilities, and he was asked to assume the following. And each of these things is specifically foretold in the Old Testament. Got to sound like a lawyer once in a while. Let's assume that in the Old Testament, the place of birth of Christ is described, the time of his birth, the manner of his birth, the betrayal when he was crucified, the manner of his crucifixion, the people's reaction to his death, such as spitting and flagellation, his piercing after his death, and his burial, and by whom. What are the mathematical probabilities of such occurring in any one man? The answer of the scientists, 1 in 10 to the 17th power. Now, I didn't know what that meant until I started looking into this, but I'll tell you what it means as a practical matter. If you had the entire state of Texas covered by silver dollars 2 feet thick, and you stirred them all up, and you reached in and you grabbed one of those silver dollars, that's the probability of those predictions, and incidentally, predictions that I recited over which Christ had no control. Absolutely none. The ones that I recited, he didn't have anything to do with. 1 out of 10 to the 17th power. The next subject matter is the subject matter of the crucifixion and resurrection, and we'll now turn off the lights and play a videotape. No. Unfortunately, we don't have a videotape of the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus Christ. But what we have learned up to now is this, is that the Old Testament predicted the death and resurrection of Christ. Christ, during his life, predicted that he was going to be killed and rise from the dead. So the question arises, what evidence is there to support it? Paul said, the Apostle Paul, and he's right, that if Christ did not rise from the dead, our faith is in vain. Because believers' faith stands or falls on the resurrection of Christ. Now, I have some evidence to present to you that I think, if nothing else, will be interesting. First of all, I want you to remember that what we're talking about is an historical event. We sometimes lose track of this. This was not a vision. This was not a hallucination. This was not an event where the apostles got together and said, okay, now we're going to have Christ rise from the dead. This is an event that took place in a time-space dimension before thousands of witnesses. One of the most publicized events in history. Before a group of people, the Jews, who had read for years about the Messiah, who were very religious, who were very sensitive to this thing. You know, the only people that were really supporters of Jesus were a few apostles, and the whole world was against him. I think it's important to keep in mind this fact, that we're talking about an historical event. There was a man named Josephus who wrote a book called Antiquities, a Jewish historian. As I understand it, what he was doing is that he was writing to the Romans, probably even to please the Romans. Keep in mind, the Romans in those days were not believers. Josephus wrote his book, Antiquities, about 90 years after the birth of Christ. He was a contemporary of Jesus Christ. That is to say, he witnessed the things that Christ did. He was a witness to the crucifixion and resurrection. He was a witness to those people who observed this. He had an opportunity to investigate it. It would be very interesting, wouldn't it, if we had such an unbiased witness, an historian, recording his observations of what occurred. Let's see what he says. Incidentally, this was also written, what I'm now going to read to you, after all of the books of the gospel were written. In other words, in the four gospels, there are four separate recitations of the death and resurrection of Christ. And what you're going to hear now is an account by a historian, not a believer, who's accurately recording the facts concerning the death and resurrection. Let me read it to you. And this was written in about 90 A.D., right? Now there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him many Jews, and also many of the Greeks. This man was the Christ. Incidentally, Christ is Greek for Messiah. This man was the Christ, and when Pilate had condemned him to the cross upon his impeachment by the principal man among us, those who had loved from the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive on the third day. The divine prophets having spoken these and thousands of other wonderful things about him, and even now the race of Christians, so named from him, has not died out. This is the best description that this Jewish historian could give of the accounts of the death and resurrection of Christ. We also have as evidence six eyewitness accounts of the death and resurrection of Christ in the Bible. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Peter, and Paul. And at the time of the events that I'm describing now, these books were well publicized, well read by Josephus as well as other historians. I'd like to propose something to you. Let's assume that it's not true. Let's assume that it's not true, that when they looked at the tomb of Jesus, it was not empty. Let's assume that that's not true. Let's assume further that Christ really did not rise from the dead. Let's assume that it's not true, the accounts that are written, that he really walked with hundreds of people after he had arisen from the dead. I'm going to ask you something. With such a well-publicized event, do you think that it's reasonable that one historian, one eyewitness, would record for all time, "Listen, I saw that tomb. It was not empty. Listen, I was there. Christ did not rise from the dead. As a matter of fact, I saw Christ's dead body." Let me put it to you another way. Let's assume a biography was written again about our President John F. Kennedy. And let's assume that this biography said the following: that John F. Kennedy was not born in Boston, didn't go to Hyannisport, was not president of the United States, was not killed in Dallas, and was not buried at Arlington. Have you ever read of such a book? No. What's the obvious reason you've never read of such a book? It ain't true. Historians don't write such books. Let's assume that such a book was in fact written by somebody. Do you think it's reasonable that one historian, one eyewitness, would record for all time, "Listen, the things that they say about John F. Kennedy is not true. He was in fact born in Boston. He was in fact killed in Dallas. He was in fact buried in Arlington"? Why, of course you would. Now the punchline. There has never been one historian, one eyewitness, nobody, who has ever said that Christ's tomb was not empty, that Christ did not rise from the dead. There has been nothing. The record is silent. Now, it's amazing, isn't it? When you consider that this is an event that everybody knew about, an event that the whole world was concerned about, the only rationalization that history records to explain the empty tomb is the fact that the guards were bribed that were guarding Christ's tomb to say that in the still of the night, these fishermen overtook 16 guards. History records there was probably 16 Roman guards. When they were all asleep, and stole his body. See, they had a problem, didn't they? You know, by the very fact that they had to go to this extent admits the empty tomb. In the trial of cases, I like to look for what I consider to be, as Daniel Webster said, "Murder will out," the one witness, the one thing, the one piece of evidence, the thing that just really points unerringly to who's telling the truth and who isn't. I want to give to your attention, call to your attention, some evidence. In the chapter, the Gospel of John, I want to read to you an account that was written by John of the resurrection, or rather of the death of Jesus Christ. Chapter 19, verses 33 to 35. This is an account by John when he was at the cross seeing Jesus killed. "But coming to Jesus, when they saw he was already dead, they did not break his legs, But one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately there came out blood and water. And he who has seen has borne witness, and his witness is true. And he knows that he is telling the truth so that you may believe. And the language I want to call your attention to is, here is an eyewitness who records his observation when the spear was pierced into Christ's side, that out came first blood and then water. There's a MD named Samuel Horton, who is a pathologist from the University of Dublin. He conducted a series of experiments in order to try to explain this phenomenon that was observed by John, who supposedly was an eyewitness. And as a result of these repeated experiments, Dr. Horton concluded the following, that the only way that could occur, that blood would be followed by water, is if, first of all, the person who's being pierced was crucified, and second of all, if he died of a ruptured heart. I want to read to you Psalm 22:14 that was written 1,000 years before the birth of Christ. I am poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within me. Coincidence? I don't think so. What does it tell us? Here's what it tells us. That this was an observation made by John, I think when he's about 20 years old, of an eyewitness account of what he personally saw when Christ's side was pierced. This guy was a fisherman. He was no pathologist. What he observed was the thing that he recorded. And incidentally, it also shows at the time Christ was in fact dead. And the last piece of evidence. I want to go back in history. And go back where it's recorded in Mark and Matthew 26:56. That when Christ was arrested, when Christ was arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane, and his disciples were present, what did they do? They really went to bat for him, and they really did the best they could to see that these bad things didn't happen. No. If you read what our heroes did, it's recorded that they left him and they fled. This indicates, first of all, to me, it was written by Matthew, who was one of the guys that left him, that they, the Bible, the authors write not only good things, but the bad things about themselves. To me, it indicates some credibility. But the point that I want to really bring out to you, and incidentally, another reason they left him, is that the Jews at that time were expecting a political Messiah, not somebody that was going to be killed on a tree, not somebody that was going to not zap the Romans, but they were expecting a political Messiah, the other reason that they left him and they fled. I want to now recite to you history. We now know that they were total cowards. Every one of those disciples died a martyr's death except John. What's the only event that occurred between the time that they were utter cowards and the time that they were willing to go to their death for Christ? It's clear that they saw the resurrected Lord. And they fell on their knees, as Thomas said, "My Lord and my God." The credentials of Jesus Christ. First of all, Jesus Christ,
I'm now going to discuss just very briefly the credentials of Christ that are set forth in the Old Testament. We're going to discuss where 400 to 1500 years before his birth, it was specifically foretold who his forefathers were going to be. And that's just like if, for example, in the Orange County Courthouse here, we had concerning Vern Hunt, a book that was written 400 to 1500 years before Vern was ever born, that specifically foretold who his forefathers are going to be. That'd be a pretty amazing book.
Does that exist? Yes, it does. If you read the Old Testament, you will find the following. That it was predicted that the Messiah, the Son of God, must come through Abraham. Abraham was the father of the Jews. That means that the Messiah of necessity had to be a Jew. Next. Abraham had two sons, Isaac and Ishmael. The Bible tells us that the Messiah must come through Isaac. Ishmael, of course, being the father of all Arabs. Isaac had two sons, Jacob and Esau. The Bible tells us that the Messiah must come through Jacob. Jacob had 12 sons that were the 12 tribes of Israel. And the Bible tells us that the Messiah must come through the tribe of Judah. There were thousands of families in the tribe of Judah. And the Bible tells us that the Messiah must come through the family of Jesse. Jesse had 8 sons. And the Bible tells us that the Messiah must come through one of those sons, David. Now that's not so amazing, but now let me tell you something else that's really amazing. That Christ said, I fulfill all of those prophecies. He had the audacity. He had no control about who his mother was going to be. He had the audacity to say, I am the person who's fulfilling each of those. Now, could you check up to see that he was right? Oh boy, you sure could. In Herod's second temple, the heritage of all Jews was set forth from Abraham to the current time. All anybody had to do was to go to the courthouse and to see if Christ fulfilled all of those prophecies. And again, history records that nobody challenged it. You know, the meaning of the crucifixion and resurrection is a theological matter. The fact of the crucifixion and resurrection is a historical matter. We do not intend to discuss in this seminar the theological significance of the crucifixion and resurrection. That's up to you. But the fact of the crucifixion and resurrection is a thing that should be decided by evidence. The fact of the fulfillment of the prophecies is something that should be decided by the evidence. And I'll tell you the conclusions that I reached. First, I reached the conclusion that if this book, the Bible, is 100% right, 100% of the time, concerning the factual data of the prophecies, the credentials of Christ, and all of these other matters that we've been discussing, it was only reasonable in my mind to conclude that the book is also right concerning the consequences of accepting or rejecting it. I concluded that the Messiah described in the Old Testament is Jesus Christ fulfilled in the New Testament. Christ told us over 30 times that I'm the Son of God. He didn't leave us any option. Christ was either a liar, a lunatic,
or he's the Lord.
Left us no option. The conclusion that you reach concerning the evidence is up to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Question time. And we are here now to be cross-examined on anything that's been presented or any other factual data concerning the Bible or anything else.
You said there were 71 prophecies in the Old Testament that Jesus fulfilled, or did he just touch them?
There are actually 300 prophecies, more than 300 prophecies concerning the Messiah, only 71 of which really deal with his first coming, all fulfilled by Jesus Christ. We can give you the citations and you can look them up.
I thought he actually fulfilled 300 prophecies.
Not yet. He's only fulfilled 71. There are 300 total, but he's only really fulfilled 71 because the rest of the predictions are, for example, in Revelations and concerning the second coming of Christ. Yes.
You referred to writings of the apostles and a Jew who wrote 90 years after the words of Christ.
Yes.
From those seven writings, you concluded that the whole world was focused upon the death of Christ. Do you have any authority other than a 90-year after-the-fact writing and the writings of six followers who might be prejudiced?
In the first place, the Jewish nation has had the predictions concerning Christ for about 1,500 years. They were expecting a Messiah. They were expecting a Messiah to be crucified. The Messiah showed up. So it was a notorious event. It was not an event that took place in a vacuum. It took place before thousands of witnesses. Yes, the world knew it was going to occur. So we did have, in fact, a notoriety. Is that what you mean? It's also been recorded by many other historians that I could recite to you. A fellow named Tacitus, who was a Roman.
Your last answer just raises two more questions.
All right.
The first one, the world knew that this Messiah was coming to earth and was going to be crucified, but hadn't the Jewish world already rejected Christ as being the Messiah and said, "You're a fraud"?
Yes, they did.
So then why should they pay any further attention to him? First question. Second question, is there any other contemporary writer who commented upon the resurrection? Then contemporary, not today. And not 600
years. Well, certainly there was. There was wasn't there a Roman historian named Tacitus, T-A-C-I-T?
P-L-I-N-Y, Tacitus, Pliny.
There's about 10 of them, yes.
Eusebius.
I can't recall them right now, but there were about 10 of them.
Herodotus also. The writings of Herodotus contain the references.
And the point that we were making is that none of those commentaries by a historian recorded anything to contradict the biblical record. My point was that if it was true that Christ did not rise from the dead, if it was true that anybody could see his body, you would think that some historian would have commented on it, and they did not.
Well, you just come up and said there were 10 who did comment in support. I was just wondering, because you'd only mentioned one.
There has been no support against.
I just wanted to add something else on that other point, and we'll get right. Okay. I think the evidence, for example, in 300 A.D., from the first 300 years after Christ's presence on this earth, you have the writings of Herodotus. You even have one of the Caesars of Rome in his official memoirs talking about these other messiahs who, because Jesus said, "I go, I'll come again, and I'm going to come back," they were already impersonating and going around and having followers, saying, "Hey, I'm Jesus Christ that came back, the one that was crucified." That in itself, as an attorney, you can look at the empirical knowledge contained there, regardless the source is valid, because it's really a non-believing force, an opposing force that had been putting Christians to death. So in other words, the reality of Jesus Christ as a factual entity in time, space, and this earth and in time cannot be refuted, cannot be ignored. It can be ignored, but it cannot be refuted. No, and a lot of choose to ignore it now.
Mark.
Yes, Mark.
How do you refute those talks about the Bible and messianic prophecy as being another pious writing in the tradition of the Gnostic writings that continued to the verse of Christ? Yes, there were many writings, at least some contributable writings, that were Gnostic messianic prophecies.
Such as?
I don't know those writings is the problem. I'm not saying they don't exist.
Are you referring? Yeah. Well, if you're talking about the missing books of Jesus or the writings or the Gospel according to Thomas, apocryphal. Now you're somewhere. The apocryphal. Okay. And your statement then, yes, there are those books that are apocryphal books, which means hidden, mysterious, and the reason they're not in the Bible, by the way, apocryphal books. And the reason they're not included is because you look at the early records, the early church for 33 years had no written record. They had these guys with them, these eyewitnesses. They had John and old Rocky, Peter, nicknamed Cephas, called him Rocky, to fit his personality perhaps. And they had these fellows firsthand to talk to them. But the writings that you're speaking of then, I don't know that they'd be called Gnostic writers. There are those, the writings of the Essenes and so on, that are rather contemporary to your question. But there are some who would include Jesus and wrap him up as an Essene then in the Essene sect of the Qumran area and so on. But this is not, again, we've got to apply textual criticism, which is a science of examining those books, examining the content, examining the eyewitness criteria and any other copies, which we do the New Testament. And we find no validity to them.
Yes, sir.
You were mentioning the textual criticism.
Yes.
And my question is with reference to the New Testament. Let's talk about the Gospels. What are the dates that they were written? I was taught at USC that the earliest writing was around 90 AD, with the latest writing being as late as 450, with most theologians agreeing it was around 400, the latest being the book of John.
Well, we have actually found the Rylands a scrap of a chapter, a scrap of a verse of the Gospel of John that we can establish scientifically that was written about 30 years after it were the original writing of John, which is about 120 A.D.
34 years precisely.
34 years precisely. So we know that it's about then 120 A.D.
120. We also have the Rylands papyri. This is all, I don't know when you were in school, I don't know how they update their curriculum there. This is another area I like to lecture on in college campuses, though, is the biblical evidences and textual manuscripts. But if you're aware of papyrology, examining scrolls and manuscripts and documents, you'll find that textual criticism applied to the New Testament 26 documents. And exactly what they come up with is this, that we found in Alexandria, the old Alexandria of Egypt, which is a crocodopolis, the old name, in the mouths of the alligators by the Egyptians buried, Christians had put in scrolls of Mark. And we now believe, and I don't know if you've been up with current events since you've been out of school in reference to this particular discussion, but a line, in fact, a four-verse line of Mark, the fourth chapter, has been found, and it's been in Jerusalem where I've worked with papyrologists on the Dead Sea Scrolls. They haven't even interpreted all of them. And he pulled out, it's an Italian papyrologist who finally, he didn't denounce it, but it was in Time magazine, all the magazines, last year. And I do believe now they're using all of the tests to the manuscript, the type of manuscript, whether it's vellum or parchment and so on, textual evidences, to see indeed if it's authentic. And it has been thus far, has survived very well. And now they're saying, Tom, this will be, in all likelihood, and again, as I'll use your generalization, most theologians, don't bring theologians, that's the study of theology. We're talking about textual criticism as a science. And there is a difference, a heck of a difference. But this is going to be called early or Marcus. And you might write that down because, and check it out, because the verification that that is the oldest piece of the New Testament, and it dates to 66, which would be the actual time of Mark, writing Mark.
Well, getting off of the New Testament and getting back to the Old Testament, I believe the problem is beginning that the books of Moses were written roughly 1500 B.C. And how do you answer the
let's not use theologians, let's use historical and literary critics who contended there were multiple hands that wrote the Pentateuch.
The Graf-Wellhausen documentary hypothesis, that's what you're referring to. Yeah, Graf-Wellhausen.
Deal with the J writer, the E writer,
J-E-D-P-H, yes, Deuteronomist. I can deal with it very well. Tom, do you want to? I happen to write my dissertation on that very topic. I'm glad you asked.
That's
that.
Why I'm letting you answer.
I see. The Graf-Wellhausen hypothesis, or the documentary hypothesis, is what it's called. Absolutely no basis. I know of no scholars today, and I mean some of the most liberal scholars in the world, will quote the Graf-Wellhausen theory right now. They got a lot of mileage at it in the 30s and in the 40s to attack the integrity of the authorship of the first five books of the Bible. Now, we believe that the text indicates Moses wrote Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, the Torah, the Pentateuch, Haftarah. My Jewish friends. And we believe this. Of course, the evolutionists again said Moses couldn't write. Man didn't evolve writing until 1500. So how could he have written these things? And of course, I say as an archaeologist, the oldest people we found in the world are the Ur of the Chaldees people in Mesopotamia. And they not only could write, they composed poetry, songs, cube root, math problems, and teachers even circled on cuneiform tablets errors in red paint and sent them home with the children. So they were pretty evolved. You know, and that's 3400 B.C., so you're talking 6,000-year-old culture. Now, to your question, there is absolutely no internal evidence, and I would challenge that. I mean, you'd have to give me some specifics, and I could refute them for you. Every indication of Genesis, see, it's all based that, like the Elohist or the E document, that there's two writers of Genesis, because in the first chapter of Genesis, he says, in the beginning, Elohim created. And then in the third chapter, he says, and Yahweh, Jehovah. And they say, two writers, because he uses two different names of God. Not when you know what the names mean. The Elohist or Eloah, the poetical Hebrew form of God, is the creative. It's only used specifically by the Hebrew to the creative God. Elohim, Ruach Elohim, created. But when he uses the father of the multitude, he calls him Jehovah or Yahweh. You see? So you get the difference in the name, and they say, two different writers. No, a smart writer using the right name for what he's describing and doing. And they used to say, the only other inference you get out of that is they say the priestly code, the Deuteronomist, they say that Moses couldn't have written Exodus, and yet you'll see words that Moses, remember, he uses mosaic words that he uses all through five books. In other words, you'll find them in Genesis 2. So we call that the mosaicity of the text. Okay?
Maybe a dispute with reference to the distinguishing between the Elohist or the Elohist. I'm aware of the theory that you just put in court.
Right.
How about the distinctions in the actual writings? For example, in one book of the Pentateuch, they refer to Moses' father-in-law as Jethro.
Uh-huh.
In another book of the Pentateuch, they refer to Moses' father-in-law as Hobab. In this one book, they refer to the Holy Mountain as Mount Horeb.
Uh-huh.
In another book, they refer to it as Mount Sinai.
I'm so glad you asked these. Oh no, it's further evidence of the changing of times and an accurate writer writing according to the time of his day, the term of that mountain. I can take you to Israel, and if any of you want to go, I'm going running tours over there. I take archaeological tours over there. We're going in March to Egypt, float down the Nile to Karnak and Luxor. Then I'll take you, we've excavated there, I'll take you to Israel. But listen, that's a good question. They also call him by the name Jethro, and his other name is called is Reguel, R-E-G-U-E-L. Again, the same answer. When you understand, for example, their own names, and this is the best illustration of all, Abram, father, becomes Abraham when he receives the promise from God of multiplication of thy seed to scatter around the world. His name is changed from Abram, or Abram, just father, to father of a multitude because he now has this promise that from his genes and his offspring the world will be blessed. And so he becomes, and the writer correctly uses the correct name, which signifies a different title. There's your explanation. Again, it's attention to detail. It shows to me even greater detail of the authorship, rather than saying, you know, it's just that we don't understand or look up what those terms mean. Abraham, Sarah. Remember what her first name was? Sarai. And Sarai meant princely. But the princess, when it becomes Sarah, it changes just that much, that little change in the spelling. She becomes, now she's the princess because she's Abraham's wife. She's going to help populate the world. So again, there's your answer. All of these names, the different names, they're not talking about different people. They're still, and look at the context they use. They describe the same person, the same events, the same goings on. Mount Horeb, a part of Mount Sinai. Mount Horeb is a part, a mountain like Pisgah. Mount Pisgah, where Moses supposedly stood and looked over the promised land, is on Mount Sinai. So it's all Mount Sinai, but you're talking specifically of Horeb. But again, it doesn't mean a multiple author. It doesn't do a thing. But it's a good question, because a lot of people can read it that way, especially if we're taught that way. We don't know.
Can I just follow the one back up question on that same line? I think the most obvious example of multiple writings that I had ever demonstrated was the Genesis 1:1, starting with the story of the creation. The Elohim wrote the first story of the creation, where God created the heavens and the earth and the firmament, and then on the sixth day he created man, and then on the seventh day he rested.
Yes.
And then, as I understand it, in 222 BC, the priestly writers added the second story that was written by.
But now, I'd have to stop you right there, because there's no evidence for any of that. That's all theory, much, I'm afraid, speculative. Highly speculative. There's no fact for what you're saying.
Well, do you have a Bible up there?
Sure. Okay. Just happen to have one.
Is there not a second story that immediately follows the first story of the creation, where everything is switched around? And
no.
The second story, man is created first, and then.
Oh, I know what you're referring to now, and okay. What you're really saying is, in the first chapter, again, when we study the writing of the whole Bible, not just Genesis, study all the Old Testament, and what do we find? We find that, and here again, you must study Hebrew poetry. This is a special study in itself. They use strophes and die stitches. They use various poetic and poetic forms. There's a very beautiful flow to Hebrew poetry. And when you understand, like did the Davidic Psalms, he used some beautiful poetic a strophe and so on. Now, in Genesis, you have a perfect summation. In the first chapter, the writer, which they do in Joshua, which he does in four other books in the Old Testament, he gives you a summation of the book, the highlights of the book. Don't you ever? We have study books now that have the synopsis of the content of the chapter in the front of the book. Then you get into the specifics, don't you? That's exactly what you have in Genesis chapter 1. Chapter 1 says, in the beginning, Ruach Elohim, God called forth from nothing something. God spoke and said, let there be light. Light existed, or sprang in, literally the Hebrew. Then it says, ex nihilo fit, he caused to be that which was not. And it says he went on, let there be the firmament. He separated the firmament from above the waters and so on. Now, the first chapter then is a recapitulation. It is a looking together of the whole content of the Genesis chapter as the writer intends to tell us what the important highlights are. Now, chapter 2, he begins to break it down specifically. And to some people, they even get a theory between chapter 1 and 2 called the gap theory. They say, well, there must have been a tremendous gap, because he destroyed the world after he created it in chapter 1, because it starts over and gets specific about man and so on. And a lot of people have a theory that he wiped out the world twice. Destroyed the world he created, then chapter 2 starts a new creation. That's called the gap hypothesis, or reconstruction and ruin theory. And they all tie into this. As I said, to me, it's a beautiful writer who's very cognizant of fact and very intelligent and very correct in Hebrew poetry and writing to give us a synopsis. Here's an overview of what you're going to get in this chapter. Now, here I'm going to spell it out. And that's what we get in Genesis. Good question. Thank you very much. Yes. Sure, you find it. It's a pattern of Hebrew writing. And it's very good. And there's a lot of books now, and even a lot of Bibles that you can get. They'll have a whole page of introduction to the book. Tell you what chapter 1 says, 2, 3, 4, 5. That doesn't mean two men wrote that. Just means they're giving you an overview, and now the man gets specific details. Yes. Attorney.
Question, I think, that pertains to the historical Christ, I suppose, but it perhaps could be better answered by you. There is a book that is called the Archco Volume. Are you familiar with that? And do you have any comments about the authenticity of the supposed reports in there?
Since it's featured in one of the weeklies?
I don't know.
I believe it was.
A few years ago, it supposedly contains Pilate's report to Caesar about the crucifixion and the resurrection, and the high priest's report to the Sanhedrin, and several other things.
I have to say, this has been circulating for years, and as my field in teaching in Christian seminary was indeed textual criticism and biblical evidences, which I'm glad I taught now that I'm here, standing here tonight. And let me tell you that that has never been substantiated. I'm still very skeptical about anything that comes down the pike. Quite honestly, I'm very skeptical about the Shroud of Turin. I just simply am. I've followed it for 15 years. I've built files on it. And it just seems, well, quite frankly, it's in Tom's presentation when he said that the guards were paid to say, while we were sleeping, his disciples came and stole the body. My question as a lawyer would be to jump up and say, if you were sleeping, how do you know who took the body? You ever think about that? They said, while we were asleep, they came and stole the body. How do you know you were asleep? Boy, you talk about incriminating yourself. Perjury. But anyway, that's the type of attitude I have toward that particular report, that there's nothing that I know of. They cannot be authenticated. These things surface. The Shroud of Turin will surface. There'll be the lost story of Christ. The sayings of Jesus is another book. Look out for these. Be careful. Okay, but your question, I know of no documentation for that report. Be great if it was. You want to take that, Tom?
No, go ahead.
Where's my attorney? May I approach the bench? You'd like to know where God comes from. Let me get your name and address and add that to the list. You know, that's an interesting question. I don't think there's any human being or child, let's say, when I was a little boy, that had ever asked the question. Rather than saying, where did he come from, is the question, is he really there? You see, that answers... Oh, well, there's your answer, really.
Well, my answer to that question is that is the only thing you have to accept on faith. That is the one thing you have to accept on faith.
What's that?
God has always existed.
That's right.
No facts.
Well, see, I wouldn't even use that word faith... honestly. There, now, let me pose this question to you, maybe a rhetorical question, but here's the idea. How do you know there's a God? Well, where did God come from if there is a God? Well, number one, let's look around the world and evaluate what we see, cause and effect. I can prove to you, factually and intellectually tonight, there is a God. I can prove it to you right now, and I might as well do it. If I had a blackboard, it'd be easier. But we know that all systems in this whole world is cause and effect, isn't it? We live in effectual causality. You in philosophy, whatever. Effectual causality, or efficient causality in Aristotle's philosophy. The idea that for every effect there's a cause, correct? Are we logical? Yes, we're rational. For every effect there's a cause. We must regress mentally, logically. There has to be, in the beginning of all our understanding, an uncaused cause. The primal cause. The prime mover that started the very first effect, right? So you have a cause and effect relationship in all of life. I threw a rock at a window and I got a spanking for it. That was cause and effect. The cause of it, the effect was my spanking from my mom and dad, and it happened to be the window where my mother was teaching school. I really got it and I deserved it. But that was cause and effect. So there's cause and effect in infinity. And now the evolutionists or the skeptic will say, yes, but you cannot regress. You can regress forever and never come to the first cause. That's not rational. There had to be an uncaused cause to be able to produce the first effect. I don't think so, because an evolutionist has a blob. I have an all-knowing, creative, thinking, intelligent being. And that really does get to the bottom line.
You have logic, but does the logic necessarily come from a being as opposed to everything else?
Yes, I would say if you walked into this building, and would you think that just sort of fell together here by itself? Or do you think there was blueprints laid and architects and draftsmen who put this building together? What would be your summation?
I would say architect.
Would you say there's design in buildings and in our world? There's design. This is a design, isn't it? Okay, our world is not chaotic, it's not topsy-turvy, there is design, it bears the imprint of design in everything you look at. So there, blob doesn't design, an intelligent being does, and we see the stamp of design in all living things.
My answer to that bit about, you know,
how do we know God existed forever, where did he come from? But along with what you're saying about faith, that the wind is an example. We don't know where it's coming from, we don't know where it's going. But I don't deny it exists just because I didn't know where it came from. Okay? That would be my answer to being for God. We know it exists. Some supreme being has to exist, as you just said, because everything is happening. But we don't know where it came from, we don't know where it's going.
There's something,
if we can't even believe that about the wind, my goodness, we should believe something about that of a superior being to the wind.
There it is, the causality. Again, there's cause and effect in our whole life. And there's design, there's blueprint, there's plan. It's everywhere, indelible. Did you have another question? Comment? Anybody else?
Anybody else?
Appreciate you all hanging on.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sure enjoyed being here. You're very kind.
Get in the back. The second speaker during the question and answer session is Bill Baker, whose topic, Evolution or Creation, is the subject of the second tape of this program on Evidence That Demands a Verdict. For additional copies of either of these two tapes on Evidence That Demands a Verdict and other tapes on biblical topics, write Firefighters for Christ, 8866 Barcelona Plaza, Westminster, California, 92683. Reproduction of these tapes for the sole purpose of spreading God's good news is highly encouraged. Remember to prove all things and hold fast to that which is good.